नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 17, Text 5 onwards.
Tatra chaturdha vidyamana chaturbhir namabhis chaturdisham abhispandanti nadanadipatim eva abhinivashati sita alakananda chakshur bhadreti.
On top of Mount Meru, the Ganges divides into four branches, each of which gushes in a different direction, east, west, north and south. These branches, known by the names Sita, Alaknanda, Chakshu and Bhadra, flow down to the ocean.
Sita tu brahma sadanat kesara chaladi girishikarebhyo adho adha prasravanti gandhamadana murdasu पतित्वांतरेण भद्रश्वावर्षम प्राच्याम दिशि क्षार समुद्रम अभिप्रविशति.
The branch of the Ganges known as Sita flows through Brahmapuri atop Mount Meru. From there it runs down to the nearby peaks of the Kesarachal mountains, which stand almost as high as Mount Meru itself. These mountains are like a bunch of filaments around Mount Meru. From the Kesarachal mountains, the Ganges falls to the peak of the Gandhamadan mountain and then flows into the land of Bhadrashva Varsha. Finally, it reaches the ocean of salt water in the west.
Evam Malyavach Shikharan Nishpatanti Tato Anuparata Vega Ketumalam Abhichakshu Pratichyam Dishi Saritpatim Pravishati.
The branch of the Ganges known as Chakshu falls onto the summit of Malyavan mountain. From there cascades onto the land of Ketumala Varsha. The Ganges flows incessantly through Ketumala Varsha and in this way also reaches the ocean of salt water in the west.
Bhadra Chottarato Meru Shiraso Nipatita Girishikharad Girishikaram Atihaya Shringavata Shringad Avasyanandamana Uttaramstu Kuran Abhita Udicham Dishi Jaladim Abhipravishati.
The branch of the Ganges known as Bhadra flows from the northern side of Mount Meru. Its waters fall under the peaks of Kumuda Mountain, Mount Nila, Shweta Mountain and Shringavan Mountain in succession. Then it runs down into the province of Kuru and after crossing through that land flows into the saltwater ocean in the north.
तथैव अलकनंदा दक्षिणेन ब्रह्म सदनाद बहुनि गिरि कूटान्य अतिक्रम्य हेमकूटाद धै हैमकूटानि अतिरभसतर रम्हसा लुठयन्ति भारतम अभिवर्षम दक्षिणस्याम दिशि जलदिम अभिप्रवेशति यस्याम स्नानार्थम चागच्छतः पुंस पदे पदे अश्वमेध राजसुयादिनां फलम न दुर्लभम इति.
Similarly, the branch of the Ganges, known as Alaknanda, flows from the southern side of Brahmapuri, Brahmasadana. Passing over the tops of mountains in various lands, it falls down with fierce force upon the peaks of the mountains Hemakuta and Himakuta. After inundating the tops of those mountains, the Ganges falls down onto the tract of land known as Bharatavarsha, which she also inundates. Then the Ganges flows into the ocean of salt water in the south. Persons who come to bathe in this river are fortunate. It is not very difficult for them to achieve with every step the results of performing great sacrifices like the Rajasuya and Ashwamedha Yajnas. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The place where the Ganges flows into the salt water of the Bay of Bengal is still known as Ganga Sagar, or the meeting place of the Ganges and the Bay of Bengal. On Makar Sankranti, in the month of January, February, thousands of people still go there to bathe, hoping to be liberated. That they can actually be liberated in this way is confirmed herein. For those who bathe in the Ganges at any time, the results of great sacrifices like the Ashwamedha and Rajasuya Yajnas are not at all difficult to achieve. Most people in India are still inclined to bathe in the Ganges, and there are many places where they can do so. At Prayag, Allahabad, many thousands of people gathered during the month of January to bathe in the confluence of the Ganges and the Yamuna. Afterward, many of them go to the confluence of the Bay of Bengal and the Ganges to take bath there. Thus, it is a special facility for all the people of India that they can bathe in the water of the Ganges at so many places of pilgrimage. So we are discussing today from the 17th chapter of the 5th canto, text 5 to 9. These verses describe the division of the river Ganga. The 5th canto is a description of the geography part of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is a Purana. Of course, it's not a typical Purana in the sense meant for people in the mode of goodness, passion or ignorance, as is the case of other Puranas being divided. Purana means old, like we have the Hindi word Purana. Comes from that. They are old narrations. Purana also has the connotation of making something complete. So it's a supplementary portion of the Vedas. And they are very essential for understanding Vedic information in total. To give a simple example, those who study laws, especially in the commerce side, there is something called a company law, which might be just one thin book like this. But if you want to have a complete understanding of what this law means, how about the transgressions which have taken place, the orders which have been passed by the court? Then when you understand the company law with respect to historical narration, we can have 20 volumes this big. And they're all expanded from one small thing like this. So similarly, Upanishads are very concise. Upanishads don't give much description. Gita is Upanishad, Gita Upanishad. And the Gita may say, the first step in getting knowledge is amanitvam, you have to be humble. But how to be humble? What's the example of some humility? What's the example of somebody not showing humility and losing his knowledge? That will come from some Purana. So in this way, the Puranas which are called Smriti, they make the whole thing complete. Unfortunately, after the advent of Mayavad of Shankaracharya, because the Puranas, they give so much in detail, and it is very difficult for anyone to prove that God is not a person from the Puranas. While the Shrutis, because they do not give much extended description, Shrutis are like for people who are very, very advanced in their knowledge of a particular subject. For example, if we see two doctors talking to each other, they might use a typical language which a layman may not understand. Two engineers, two software engineers are talking to each other that connect this to the USB here. Now, what does USB mean to a layman if he doesn't understand? It's all code words. Similarly, the rishis who discuss Upanishads, when they discuss things, it is very difficult for the common man to follow. But the Puranas, when they give historical narrations to support what the Shrutis say, then it becomes very easy to understand. So what the Mayavadis did, they said the Smritis are not important, or the Smritis are not bona fide. One need not read the Smritis. If something is in the Smritis, we don't accept it as evidence. And for one part of time, almost all of India was under their control. So even today, people say, Krishna is God. Well, the Smritis say that Krishna is God. But do you have any example in the Smritis? Do you have some hardcore Vedic evidence? Does the Rig Veda say somewhere that Krishna is God? Or the Samaved or the Atharvaved? Well, it need not be like that. And of course it is there. Like the Rig Veda says, there is one supremely worshipable cowherd boy. Now just see how difficult it is to understand. Now, who is this supremely worshipable cowherd boy? You mean to say that all cowherd boys are worshipable? No. It just says there is one supremely worshipable transcendental cowherd boy. So you have to find out who is the cowherd boy among so many millions and billions who is transcendental. Another example, Shavalat Shamam Prapadye. Shama Shavalam Prapadye. It's very tricky. Shavalaj is black, white, and Shama is black. With the help of the black, I get support of the white, or I surrender to the white. With the help of the white, I surrender to the black. He may say, what does it mean? It means Radharani, who is very, very fair. By worshipping her, you can surrender to the black, who is Krishna. And Krishna, by worshipping him, you can follow in the footsteps of Srimati Radharani. But of course, we would be charged with, oh, it is your interpolation. This is just your interpretation. How do you know that? So we can't prove to them because they are obstinate, and they can't prove to us that this is wrong. So this is the status today. And of course, like we saw this beautiful presentation given by Radha Vallabh Prabhu a few days ago. He had a nice multimedia presentation about the geography of this fifth canto. I was just going through some archival information about what did devotees during Prabhupada's presence here, how did they understand? And there are so many conversations, especially one when the fifth canto illustrations were about to be made. And there is a big discussion between, at that time there was one Bhakti Prem Maharaj who was translating Bhagavatam into Hindi, and he had some knowledge. He was Advaiti before, then he surrendered to Prabhupada. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Yashodhanandan Maharaj, who were mainly involved. And they were saying, Srila Prabhupada, all this thing is very revolutionary. We can't understand it. That there is a gold mountain, and on the northern side is this, on the southern side is that. How are we going to convince the outsiders? So Prabhupada said that, first of all, do you accept it? So then they were going back and forth, well, sometimes, little bit. And then Prabhupada said, you are prejudiced. This is your Western prejudice. Prejudice means you charge someone even before the charges are proved. You frame somebody and say that he is bad. So Prabhupada said, you are prejudiced. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj goes on the defensive. He says, no, I am not prejudiced. I am just trying to understand, how can we explain this geography to the others? So Prabhupada seems to take a stance that this cannot be understood by those who don't follow a particular way of life. And this raises another question, that how do we understand Vedic information? So Devamrita Swami Maharaj has written a nice book called Searching Vedic India. Nice book. And he expands upon one particular premise, that Vedic knowledge is state specific. Vedic knowledge depends upon the state of your mind, not the state of the book. How you approach it is the way this knowledge will reciprocate with you. So if you read Shakespeare, you don't need to be Shakespeare's disciple or a lover of Shakespeare's language. You can read Shakespeare with extreme anger and extreme hatred towards Shakespeare. And pretty well you can understand whatever he has written, because whatever is written is simple English. There's nothing transcendental to it. That doesn't happen with Srimad Bhagavat. That doesn't happen with the Vedas. If you go and approach Vedic knowledge with a view to refuting it, with a view of not becoming a student, you will land up somewhere else. That's the main point being described here. So Prabhupada brings up similar points which he would with in some other discussions also, that first you need to have a guru. Tadvidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya. Otherwise you cannot understand. And he gives the example of a bull who is crushing grains. And he says this bull is blind, because normally when they crush grains, that person may feel confused as to where he is going. So therefore, they put a blindfold. And the bull is going around that pole. So Prabhupada says that bull thinks he has gone 300 miles away, because he is walking for such a long time. But we know he's right here. He's not gone anywhere. So what is his knowledge? If you ask him, where are you now? He says, well, I was in Bombay when I started, and now it is about 10 hours since I'm working. So at least I should be beyond Pune now. But if you tell him, no, you're right here, he says, impossible. I know, I'm doing the walking. So in this way, whose knowledge is perfect? He is blind, he can't see. You are not, you can see. So similarly, unless we accept that we are blind, the first understanding in Vedic, first step in understanding Vedic literature is to understand that we are having four defects. Every living entity has four defects. Brahma, Pramada, Vipralipsa, Karanapatava. Your senses are... Our senses are imperfect. We cannot see beyond this wall. We cannot hear. We cannot do so many things. Just like we were going in a train, and now the army also uses sniffer dogs to find out whether someone is carrying any explosive or not. Now, why can't human beings understand what a dog cannot understand? But our nose is not that capable. Now, dog's nose also is not perfect, but his nose can identify 150,000 different kind of smells. And like a computer, make a special file, make a special folder for all of them. And that's why if a criminal is about to be caught, if they know he's somewhere, all they need to do is give some object which the criminal is wearing, like a shirt or a handkerchief, give it to the dog. And the dog can isolate that particular smell as a separate file, using today's language, and can go in the direction where he only isolates that particular smell, while others cannot. So, what does a human being, how can a human being claim that his knowledge is even comparable? We need perfect knowledge, but our knowledge is not even comparable to other lower species than us. Or to speak of devas and their knowledge. So with imperfect senses, we always tend to be in illusion. I also got a nice definition of what illusion is. Prabhupada says it is day. Why you call it a day? Because you see the sun. And when you say there is no sun, therefore it is night. So Prabhupada says, I say you are in illusion. There cannot be a time when there is no sun. The sun is always there in the sky. It is you who have changed your position, and now you are saying there is no sun. So please try to understand, if I am standing in front of someone and that someone is removed, then I can say that he was here, now he's not there. But if I am standing in front of someone and I go like this and say, now he's not here. Well, it is you who have to change yourself. So that's how we have to understand, or we begin to understand all these different levels of geographical information given here. So the illusion is not in the sun is always there. It is we who change our position. So coming, linking to the original point, that Vedic knowledge is state specific. You change your state, this knowledge will make sense to you. You tend to become more rajasic, tamasic, you'll find this world completely different. So with imperfect senses, then you further fall into illusion, and the result is obvious, mistakes. Mistake is you take something what it is not. A mistake, error. Error also has its root, is to wander away, to go somewhere else. The word, English word error, the root is you go somewhere else. So just like you have a nice car and you are speeding it down the freeway at 140 kilometers an hour, and then someone tells you, I have something to tell you. He says, don't disturb me now. I'm fully concentrating on going at this speed and keeping the car in control. He says, no, I have to tell you something. We are heading in the wrong direction. So therefore, today's science and technology, or today's proud human society, is bent on developing the car, improving the engine, improving the standard of the car inside, steering wheel, control, everything can be improved. But unless some acharya comes and tells you, sorry, that direction, you're going in the wrong direction. The direction is a choice of the driver. Those boards outside, they don't force you to go here or there. It's you who have to decide. So therefore, that is the understanding of when we commit mistakes. But unfortunately, to cover the first three, the living entity cheats. He still thinks that my knowledge is valuable. I think. In one humorous conversation, there was something, and Prabhupada said, anyone knows the meaning of this word? And it was a simple thing, but many devotees didn't say anything. So Prabhupada said, if somebody doesn't know, then he remains a fool. So Harishwari Prabhu volunteered, said, I think. And Prabhupada says, if you don't know and then you think, then you're a rascal. So don't remain a fool. That's not good. Animals are foolish. But when you are a fool and you don't care for knowledge, and then when you start thinking about it, he says, what will your thinking help you? How will it help you? So, in a very nice way, he brought out the point that our thinking and trying to understand should be in the footsteps of the acharyas. So, all these descriptions, like Radha Vala Prabhu so nicely pointed out, that when the Britishers, especially Thomas Wilson, Goldstucker, and all those people, when they started reading Vedic literature, their goal was to prove it that this is something lower than their books, what they were bringing. Like Prabhupada studied in Scottish Churches College. Obviously, it was run by missionaries. And their goal was to prove that your books are not good. So this mentality still prevails, that my God can beat up your God. My God is more powerful. My political party is more powerful. We got more votes. I am more richer than you. I am more powerful. I can kill you. I can do this to you. This also comes in spiritual life, where you feel that my God is more powerful than your God. Well, the Vedas actually don't subscribe to this foolish idea. Ekam sat vipra bahuda vadanti. There's only one God. But that one God doesn't mean that everything is God. There is one God and there is expansions. So, when you read Bhagavad Gita, you find Prabhupada is saying, so this earth is God, water is God, ground is God, we are sitting on Krishna. But that doesn't mean I am Krishna or I am sitting on Krishna, so this ground is worshipable. How we worship Krishna, there is a specific science. There are 9 holes in the body, but there is only 1 bona fide hole of accepting food. You can't push food here. You can't push food it here. That will be catastrophic. That will mean death to someone. So the same food which is nourishing has to be put through a bona fide process. A cow's body produces milk. There is only 1 outlet for bringing it up, out. You can't push her tail and bring her milk. So, if somebody says a cow's give milk, okay, then I'll just try to pull her ears and get milk from her. No. There is a specific process. So therefore, this brings us to the point that when one understands that we have these 4 defects, so in that conversation, Prabhupada says that if these devotees are, it was a nice way, Srila Prabhupada would encourage devotees to become the devil's advocate. And sometimes sannyasis would take the position of, who cares for your Bhagavad Gita? Like he would pose himself as a materialistic scientist or whatever, and then Prabhupada would smash them. And this way they would get trained up by Prabhupada. So Prabhupada says, if you don't accept this book, if you don't accept my book, I don't care for your book even. My position is, you first of all fulfill the conditions which are necessary for understanding this. If without fulfilling the conditions you try to understand, then how is it possible for me to give you that information? So therefore, all scriptures are full of miracles. Now, what is a miracle? A mountain of stone, perfectly normal. You go on the way to Pune, you find so many stone mountains. You will be bored by them. Gold mountain? No way. You can't have a gold mountain. Emerald mountain? Like you go towards Bandra, a whole canal flowing with sewage, perfectly normal. But a whole canal flowing with mango juice, you say, oh, this is fantasy. It can't be real. Now, why it can't be real? Well, first of all, how can someone afford making a gold mountain? Well, we are not talking of some Tom, Dick and Harry making a mountain. We are talking of God. So whether God has that capability or not, so it brings to the square one that this geography is not constructed by the Disney company or some special works, special effects company. This is made by God himself. So what is miracle for God? There is no miracle. Lord Chaitanya was having his pastimes, Sankirtan all day, Sankirtan all night, chant, dance. And one day, Lord Chaitanya just took a mango seed, one mango seed, pushed it in the ground. And devotees were observing that, you know, what's going to happen now? And suddenly a tree sprang forth from that seed, right before their eyes. The tree grew, it had normal leaves, it gave normal shade, it had a normal size, but it gave completely abnormal mangoes. The mangoes were the same color, red, yellow, but they had no seed inside and no skin outside. It was all fruit, all juicy pulp. So the Lord personally gathered about 200 of these mangoes and he started giving to all devotees. And everyone took one, and the Lord was giving more, but the juice was so succulent that even one mango made a person fully satisfied. So of course we devotees, we go there, Amraghat, in our Gaur Mandal Bhumi Parikrama, that's a very important stage. Now you may say, but why that tree doesn't give mangoes to me now? So therefore, these miracles, or if we can call them miracles, we just prefer to call them Leela. The word Leela has its roots in the understanding of play. It's a play. It's not that it is, there is a lot of planning into it. For example, I mean, I don't wish to criticize anyone, but we see sometimes in many places devotees perform Govardhan Leela. And it's a big effort to make that Govardhan and to pull it. Sometimes devotees use pulleys. So like in one play I was watching, all credit to what they did. But when they started cranking up the pulley, it started making all kinds of sounds. So just to make a small drama Govardhan, where a small boy is playing the role of Krishna, and there are 3-4 strong men who are making the thing go up. We started making so many crazy sounds, and we could all understand what's happening inside. Or sometimes a Govardhan is already attached to the roof, and it is just sort of supported. In fact, in Satara, the Krishna had to actually pull it down because the Govardhan went. The devotees were so ecstatic that he pulled Govardhan so high that finally it was a lower it because it has to touch Krishna's small finger. So anyway, we do these dramas to remind ourselves of how Krishna did it. But Shukadeva Goswami doesn't describe any kind of painful sounds coming from the background that when actually Krishna lifted Govardhan, or Krishna's veins bulging, or his forehead, beads of perspiration forming on his forehead, and he's like when Prabhupada saw the Greek hero Atlas, he's carrying the earth on his back, and he's like, oh, he's training. And the Greek mythology glorifies him for carrying the earth on his back. And Prabhupada says, Krishna is not like that. He doesn't need to strain. If you strain, that means this is a task. It's a chore. It's a imposition on you. For Krishna, everything is just swabhaviki jnana bala kriyacha. Swabhaviki. All these potencies are just waiting. Just like a very powerful person, if he comes home, and normally he just wants something to be done. So there are different people, and he just stands, and that man does his job. So similarly, if a common man can show this kind of prowess, why God cannot do? So all the devotees are very pleased by tasting those mangoes. One day, the devotees were chanting, the kirtan was going on, and suddenly black ominous clouds started forming. And normally clouds remind us of Krishna's color, so they're not so bad. But that time the devotees were thinking that now I think our kirtan will stop. So the Lord just took kartals and telling everybody to chant Hare Krishna very loudly. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And when they looked up, the clouds dispersed. They just left. That place also is celebrated, Meghera Chhara. All the clouds, they just dispersed. So, miracles are not uncommon for God to perform. In fact, whatever He does is actually a miracle or miraculous. And that's why every step, every subtle nuance, everything happening in His life is worth documenting, is worth reading, is worth repeating, because it is purifying. Similarly, when we understand these concepts, now they might be completely out of reach of, say, 99.9% of us. Like when we read fifth canto, we may just say, okay, I just have faith. I just need to have faith. Please, please, Prabhupada, don't let me doubt this. We may have this kind of, we may need to build ourselves up. But
That's part of the process.
How many times we may feel cheated by so many so-called inventions, discoveries done in the material field? Smoking is good for you. Actually, doctors should say that. It doesn't cause any harm. It doesn't cause any harm which can't be cured by penicillin. And now the same doctor's descendants, they said, don't touch it, it's very bad. DDT is good for you. And I was like, oh, don't touch it, it's very bad. So when this is a common thing which I observe, in the material realm, when something is made, that is a cause for celebration. And after 3 decades, when it is stopped, that's a cause for celebration. Isn't it? Somebody gets a prize for discovering a chemical. They say, oh, this is such a brilliant scientist. And then another scientist gets a Nobel Prize for stopping this fellow's inventions. So, how long can we vacillate between these two positions? So, in one way, these descriptions, although they are fantastic, not fantasy, they are out of proportions. We have no experience of a mango juice river or a solid gold mountain. But at the same time, look in your own hearts. Don't you feel attracted to a solid gold mountain? You may say, what if I go there, take some out and bring it here and sell it and become rich? I mean, what's the need to deal in the market every day? Just get one small stone from these heavenly planets. But the fact is, you can't bring it here and sell it. If you try to sell it there, nobody's going to purchase it. Who wants to buy? Can you sell 3 liters of salt water from this ocean right here? People say, well, I have to buy from you. I can go and take it myself. So similarly, since there is no value for salt water here, when it is so much available in plenty, similarly that gold has no value for people there. It's always the grass is always green on the other side. Like scientists today see the moon and they say, how much manganese must be there and so much iron ore, maybe plutonium also, maybe uranium too. So what will go? We'll go there, take it some, and the cost of transportation will be very exorbitant. So the whole thing is geared towards bringing everything to my place where I can enjoy. That's the root cause of material existence. Prahlad Maharaj condemns this. Griha vratanam. Griha vrat means I am staying where I am. I won't change my locus standi, my position. But I'll bring everything from everywhere in the world, around the universe if possible, and enjoy. Ravana wanted to see the heaven. So they say, but heaven means you have to do tapasya. Now what is that? I don't care for any tapasya. Don't tell me any rules. It's a high place, right? There is some geographical distance involved. I'll consider a staircase. So when I want, I'll go, I'll enjoy, I'll come back. Because Lanka is where my roots are there. I won't change this place. Like someone told Prabhupada, these Russian cosmonauts, they're actually seeing the earth from a vantage point no one has seen before. And Prabhupada said, but what are they trying to find out? No, he was trying to find out how Moscow looks from above. Prabhupada said, just see, he's going so much above, but his attachment is to Moscow. Why can't he see some other things? He says that the same mentality of a vulture. Material nature has given him an eyesight so sharp, he can see something 12 miles away. But what's his object of concentration? A dead corpse. That's what he wants. He doesn't want to see a lotus from 12 miles away. He said, oh, I can't eat that. But a corpse, oh, that's good. So therefore, unless we change our position that this is a transitory place, although everything is changing, we don't change the mentality that I am going to stay here. I feel so attached that I want everything here. In another way, these kind of descriptions also prod somebody who is not willing to go for pure devotional service to at least make him realize that I thought my village was all in all. I thought my state was all in all. Like in India, we have one gold mine somewhere in South India. And it's also, it's not cost effective to mine gold there. We know gold is there, but you have to take in 1,000 tons to get 10 grams. So who wants to do that? So when we have this kind of mathematics, and then we see Mount Meru is 16,000 yojana things full of gold, at least that living entity is told that, don't think everything is in your own village. It's called Kupa Manduka Nyaya. Kupa is a well. Manduka is a frog. And he thinks, my God, what a body of water. Really huge. So he's told that there's an ocean. Unless he's brought out and shown the ocean, how else can he progress further? So there's a specific reason, as I said earlier, the Bhagavatam is a part of a Puranic literature. Puranic literature have to have some geographical description. That's like one of the constituents of any Puran. So it does it. But because it is Bhagavat Puran, it gives the information in such a way that one understands that nowhere in any of these regions will I find eternal happiness. Without Bhagavat Puran, there is simply compromise. Oh, here there is, like in some purport we'll find later, that in the heavenly planets there is sexual union between the male and female, but there is no pregnancy. And somebody who just so troubled with these things may say, let me go there. At least I can enjoy a happy family life without botheration of children. But that takes only one part of the problem. It doesn't say there is no death. In fact, the demigods are described as amara, and then in the next words it says, and when they leave their bodies. So that death is not as painful, as excruciatingly bad experience as we say here. But still death is there. What if somebody shakes your hand and then you die? Would you like to have that kind of death? A very beautiful person just comes and, or you just sign some paper and that's how you die. That death would be nice. But the Bhagavatam says, but why death? Why should you compromise? And therefore, it is meant for those who want to have no compromise with any material situation. So the geographic description is part of some other Phalashruti which comes. If you read Dhruva Maharaj's pastimes, you can become a king. Or you read Gajendra's pastimes, your bad dreams will go away. Or if you want a good wife, worship Uma. If you want this, you worship that. Ultimately, it is meant that no compromise with any situation in this material world. And we'll find that the fifth canto of Bhagavatam, it describes the heavenly situations. It describes the hellish situations. Because heaven is part of the dual thing. Once there is heaven, like materialism means when something is good, then you say, okay, what is the opposite of that? Oh, Shrutya Goswami says, you are very intelligent. The opposite of that is a hellish planet. So all the smiles which come when you see these golden mountains, they all will disappear when we read about the hellish planets. But Shukadev Goswami is telling to a king, a Rajarshi, a pure devotee of Krishna. And his first question is, my God, it's so terrible. How can someone be saved from going to these hellish planets? And Prabhupada says, that is a Vaishnava. Shukadeva Goswami is describing all these things, but the thought doesn't come in Parikshit Maharaj's mind that, what if I can go there? I mean, Krishna Loka, everything is there, I know for sure. But practically speaking, this is much easier. He doesn't have that thing. He says, no means no. Tell me, what is the duty of somebody who is about to die? And he says, you just have to absorb in hearing transcendental narrations of Krishna. So, to summarize, I had read this about special effects, which we are sometimes so fond of, especially the movie industry is practically running on special effects. So there was one authority, one expert in that. He said, I understand this in this way. If everybody expects something to happen and nothing happens, then there is awe and reverence and some, you are wonderstruck. And if everybody expects nothing to happen and suddenly something happens, then also you are surprised, isn't it? How are you surprised? You are only surprised in these two ways. Like somebody plants a bomb in a vehicle and there is one wire which is loose, and then the main hero of that part is driving and somehow it is coming very close. And you are speaking, right now he's going to burst into flames and somehow he's saved. So that causes some wonder. Or if somebody is thrown down a cliff and you say, my God, he's about to die, and suddenly he comes up and says, I'm alive. So that's also part of a special effect. So, Krishna is the original personality behind making these things. All his pastimes are filled with these ways. Like Krishna is in the grips of Kaliya and everybody expects him to die. And he doesn't die. Some demon has caught Krishna, nothing happens. Somebody throws a weapon at Krishna, nothing happens. The other extreme is when Kalyavana, untouchable king, he says to Krishna, come on, fight. And instead of fighting, Krishna runs away. And he says, what? And mind you, it is not that this is the first time Krishna has seen Kalyavana and decided to run away. Kalyavana is a hired fellow of Jarasandha, or they have some kind of pact, some treaty. And Jarasandha has been defeated 17 times. Not one or twice. And then when Krishna sees him, God knows. I mean, not he is God himself, so he knows what he's doing. So suddenly he decides to run away. And that causes everything. Everything is put in turmoil. So therefore, Krishna can do anything. When the boys would come from the pasturing grounds of Vrindavan and they would discuss so many things to with their family members, the Brajavasis would hear everything. But their bottom line was, Krishna is wonderful. He can do anything. Similarly, when we read these descriptions, if we were to follow in the footsteps of the Brajavasis, this is the most, this is common sense, that Krishna can do anything. And as Prabhupada told one disciple, he said, I'm trying to read your books, but sometimes I find them difficult to understand. So Prabhupada said, then read again. These books are not like your mundane books, that the knowledge is limited to their two covers. If you approach in the right spirit, repeated reading will give you that understanding. So we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Any questions? Comments? Grantara Shrimad Bhagavat Mahapuran ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.